From the studios of Farm Journal Broadcast, this is U.S. Farm Report.
Welcome to U.S. Farm Report this weekend. I'm Tyne Morgan, and here's what's in store over the next 60 minutes. USDA takes drastic steps to try to slow the spread of highly pathogenic avian flu in cattle.
I think it gives us the idea that, it's more prevalent than what we've given it credit for.
As new data suggests, the outbreak is more widespread than official reports. A margin squeeze in row crops, and now concerns about consolidation are sprouting.
More than three quarters of the respondents said yes, we think that will accelerate consolidation in the row crop industry.
The latest from this month's Ag Economist's Monthly Monitor. Farming on the edge of innovation.
Actually, just over here on this 40, I had this wild hair.
He's an Illinois farmer who's a maverick in the field.
U.S. Farm Report, presented by Pioneer. What's next happens when the name on a cap matches the power of one's purpose. Pioneer, what's next happens here.
Now for the news, we begin with multiple new developments regarding the outbreak of avian flu in dairy cattle. USDA issuing a federal order this week to try and stop the spread of H5N1 in dairy cattle and develop a baseline for limiting transmission. Part of it goes into effect on Monday. It requires that prior to interstate movement, all lactating dairy cattle must receive a negative test for the influenza A virus. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack says testing will then be expanded to all cattle.
Owners of herds in which dairy cows test positive for interstate movement will be required to provide biological information, including animal movement tracing. And dairy cattle that does in fact move interstate will have to adhere to the conditions established by APHIS in the guidance that will be published tomorrow.
We really believe that following the recommendations and requirements that come out from our federal and state animal health officials are appropriate. They are the brain trust for our response to this and making sure that we do our best as the dairy industry to maintain and protect the health of our dairy cattle in all 50 states.
Owners of herds where dairy cattle tested positive will be required to provide epidemiological information, including movement tracing. And all labs and state vets must report testing results to APHIS. Vilsack says these steps are necessary after confirming the virus has spread from birds to cows and from cow to cow. However, they found no changes to the virus, making it more transmissible to people. He says FDA and the industry will also be increasing testing throughout the food chain. That's after virus fragments were detected in milk in the commercial supply. However, officials say those fragments are not live or infectious after pasteurization or cooking, making meat and milk safe to eat. We'll have more from one of the labs that helped discover those fragments and why consumers can feel safe about the milk they drink. That's coming up in Chip's Corner. Also from USDA, it's officially announcing new nutrition standards for school meals. The new standards will limit added sugars for the first time. Those limits on foods such as cereals, yogurt, and flavored milk will start next year. And by 2027, added sugars will be limited to no more than 10% of total calories per week in school meals. The National Milk Producers Federation thanking USDA for keeping low-fat flavored milk in schools under the program. The new rule also trims sodium in kids' meals. Officials say the updates will also make it easier for schools to access locally sourced products, benefiting both schools and the local economy. The program serves breakfast to more than 15 million students and lunch to nearly 30 million children each day. By Memorial Day, that's when Republicans on the House Ag Committee say they will have a markup of the new farm bill. Officials saying on X, formerly known as Twitter, that the bill will strengthen the farm safety net, national security, and conservation spending, all without cutting SNAP benefits. House Ag Committee Chairman G.T. Thompson saying recently that of the 435 members of Congress, over half have never debated or voted on a farm bill before, calling that a unique challenge that requires a lot of education to bring people up to speed. So when could we see a farm bill finally passed? Results from the April Ag Economist's Monthly Monitor this week shows not a single ag economist thinks we'll see a farm bill passed in 2024. 40% think it could be the first half of next year. Nearly 50% say the second half of 2025, and some economists even think it could be as far out as 2026. An update to a case involving an Arizona rancher accused of killing a migrant on his property, a judge declaring a mistrial. 75-year-old George Allen Kelly was charged with a second-degree murder in the shooting death of a migrant. The shooting happened in January of last year on Kelly's property near the border. Prosecutors said Kelly recklessly fired 9 shots from a rifle toward a group of men, including the individual that was killed. Kelly has said he fired warning shots in the air, but he did not shoot directly at anyone. Jurors were not able to reach a consensus on the shooting. A hearing will be held the next week to see if the Santa Cruz County Attorney's Office wants to retry the case. All right, that's it for the news. Severe weather this weekend and more planting delays. We'll have a check of your forecast coming up next.
U.S. Farm Report weather is brought to you by H&S Manufacturing. Maximize baleage yield with less time and effort with the LW1100 Line Wrap Bale Wrapper. You can wrap round or square bales, and the automatic operating mode allows for a one-person operation.
Time now for a check of the weather. Martin Lowermore joining us this weekend. Martin, I know you're keeping an eye on the severe weather and that threat this weekend, but let's look at next week. What areas have the best chance for moisture and could see some planting delays?
Yeah, we are looking at the possibility for strong to severe thunderstorms all this weekend and continuing even into parts of our work week. What's going to bring it also is plenty of rain. The possibility of flooding is definitely going to be out there for parts of the central and southern parts of the plains. You can see areas up toward on our legend. We got here 2-3 inches widespread across parts of Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, even stretching up all the way to Iowa and even into Minnesota. So plenty of these areas could be seeing rain over the next several days. It's not really going to be until this low pressure finally makes its way out of the central and southern plains that we will stop seeing a lot of that rainfall. Areas that do desperately need to see it, though, out toward the west of Amarillo and southwest New Mexico. But after we actually see this cold front and its associated low pressure move out, we're going to be getting quite warm across most of the nation. Only lone exception is going to be out toward the Pacific Northwest, where they're going to be starting to see that next low pressure system make its way through. So it'll be something they'll have to look out for. Precipitation, again, with this cold front moving through, above average precipitation, but out toward the parts of the eastern U.S. actually sitting on that high pressure still. High pressure dome is out toward the Atlantic right now, so it's still feeling those effects, staying dry as we head into our next couple of days. But that jet stream, you can see it right there. There's that low pressure making its way up and over. We're going to start seeing what we call more linear flow moving across the entire U.S. This right here will help us in staying warm and calm, I might add. We're going to be watching, of course, these low pressures to our north, but still staying very linear. A lot of these moving straight east to west. This is what we call a normal flow right here for our jet stream. This is going to continue into our work week until that next low pressure system is starting to rear itself up as we get into our late week this week. We'll finally start seeing a bit of a change in that forecast, but overall, much calmer weather is going to be in store for places that are seeing plenty of those storms already moving across as we get into our weekend and the first couple of days of our work week. So planting more than likely will get done for places that don't usually get to see it as we head into the next part of your forecast for your weekend. Just hoping it can hold off just a little bit longer. We can get that more of that planting done. Of course, looking at the drought monitor, we're looking much better for most areas. You're seeing places out toward Iowa that had a lot of extremely severe drought. Now dropping this down, only places that really desperately need the rain. Still, southern New Mexico, haven't seen a whole lot of rain in the past several days, but the rest of the country is doing good on drought monitor.
Thanks, Martin. Well, what's gotten into the wheat market? It went crazy this week. And a look at one country betting big on sustainable aviation fuel. Peter Meyer and Treg Cronin join me for a marketing discussion next. Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report this weekend. As promised, we have Treg Cronin as well as Peter Meyer joining us on the show this weekend. All right, Treg, when we were looking at planting progress, recent forecasts, I mean, you look at this weekend, flooding, possible flooding rains into next week in Oklahoma, parts of the Delta, through Missouri, Illinois, even into the Western Great Lakes region. But as we enter May, when does planting pace start to move the markets, or does it this year?
That's a great question, Tyne. Personally, I'm not getting excited about it yet. I think you have to get out to the 14th, 15th of May and still see significant progress lags before the market's going to get super excited. Part of that being, I think many in the market believe that we're probably going to see higher corn acres in June than what we received in March from the USDA. So I think we're working with a little bit of a buffer anyway. But the other thing is that as recently as last fall, we were still making, everyone was making observations about the root zone soil moisture, the drought monitor, and trying to make kind of a bull story for how dry we were. And so we've got plenty of room to take in moisture at this point. It's not like we've got saturated soils and there's nowhere for this water to go. I think we've got plenty of room to take it in. We've still got time. We're working with a buffer. And so personally, I'm not getting excited about it, especially with how quickly we can plant this crop. So today, not excited. 2 weeks from now, if we're still showing, some deficits, then maybe that's time to get excited. But today, I'm not getting excited about it.
Pete, Trigg mentioned acreage. And our latest Ag Economist Monthly Monitor shows economists are not sold on USDA's prospective plantings report. In fact, they think we could see at least 1 million more acres of corn planted, maybe even 2 million more acres of corn planted. If that is the case, what could that mean for the corn balance sheet as well as prices?
Well, the reason that nobody's excited about the prospective plantings report, and I'm not excited about it either, so the economists in your group, and I am part of your group, is the fact that the prospective plantings report is the most inaccurate report that NAS puts out. And when you talk to Lance Honig and the guys at NAS, they hate putting it because they just think it's a useless report. So back to your question, though, I'll get off my soapbox there. I think you probably get 2 million more acres in there. Will it matter in the grand scheme of things? I don't know. I really don't think so. We have a whole growing season in front of us. Trigg was just talking about a buffer. We have a buffer. I mean, if we were to get half the corn crop planted by, let's say, the first week of May or the first 10 days in May, then you'd have a negative to the market. Will this rain stop that from happening? Sure. So that's going to give you a little bit of time, right? That's going to give you some time here before we get to the acreage report. I mean, certainly the knee-jerk reaction to 2 million more acres is going to be negative, but in the grand scheme of things, we still have heavy supply.
Trigg, let's talk about wheat. What in the world got into the wheat market this week?
Well, I think you could point to a number of factors, but the first thing I'm going to look at is the structure. We've been sitting on giant short positions in Minneapolis, Kansas City, and Chicago wheat for months. Everybody's been talking about it, and it almost feels like somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you talk about it enough, at some point it's going to matter, and right now it's starting to matter. You're seeing large drops in open interest with all these double-digit daily increases in wheat price, and so we're getting that round of short covering. Seasonally, we do tend to see some strength out of wheat and then right into harvest. And so, again, this isn't anything magical from a seasonal perspective. It's probably actually normal. We've got some dryness concerns in Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, the heart of the HRW belt. That's definitely goosing the wheat market a little bit. You throw in the Russian attacks on some of the Ukrainian ports. That's enough to spur some short covering. Is it anything to think that this is going to be a major fundamental shift? If it extends into May and past then we've got something.
All right, well, also this week, UK imposing a 10% SAF requirement by the year 2030. We're gonna ask Peter Meyer about that next. All right, welcome back. Just before the break, we were talking about wheat prices. Pete, before we move on to talk about SAF, is the action in the wheat market, is it having any impact on corn?
I think it's an underlying support factor for corn. I mean, certainly beans look awful. We talked a little bit earlier about the acreage as well. If wheat continues to go up and pull corn with it, then a bigger case for us having more, a million or two more corn acres by the time we get to June 30th.
Well, looking at the demand front, on Thursday, UK imposing a 10% SAF requirement by 2030. That's in addition to the EU's 6% requirement by 2030. Pete, break it all down for us. What does this mean?
Domestic airlines in the U.S. already have a 10% soft target of 10% of their fuel coming from sustainable aviation fuel by 2030. But the UK now has made that a government mandate. The difference between the UK and the U.S. is that the U.S. is talking, or we're waiting for confirmation of the 45Z tax credit. So there will be some money coming to SAF production. In the UK, it's not. in the UK, it's void of any sort of tax credit. So they're going to have to get there somehow. They will likely get there not the way that the U.S. is going to get there. The U.S. is going to get there via the alcohol to jet equation, but they're going to have to get there. So 10% by 2030 is the same mandate that, or it's the same goal that United has, Southwest has, Delta has. So yeah, when you add that though, 6%, EU is 6% by 2030. You know, the headlines just keep coming.
Yeah, well, one of those headlines is we saw the first cargo of sugar-based ethanol show up at the plant in Georgia. When we look at the SAF, when we look at that landscape here in the U.S., you know, can we do it with mandates? Or, Craig, do you think we do need some help from the government when it comes to tax credits? Is that how we're going to make SAF work?
Well, I think depending on how quickly you want it to happen, I think you can make the argument that we need the tax incentives and the tax support. And Pete and I have had conversations about this, that, you know, it's unfortunate that it seems that we can never have anything organic in this country. We have to have massive laws, massive subsidies, tax incentives. Nothing can kind of, you know, just happen organically. But that aside, yeah, if you want this to happen in the foreseeable future, you have to have the support there. Otherwise, I mean, I don't think these companies will make the investments that you're talking about. And not only that, but then you won't have the farmers on board with the sustainable practices that it's going to take. If they're not being incentivized to, you know, to change how we're all currently raising corn and need to, you know, to do it in a more sustainable way so that we check all the boxes. So yeah, I mean, I think if you want it to happen within this decade, you need the tax incentives, you need the structure there. Again, I just think it's too bad that nothing can kind of happen organically without the government passing massive legislation, a ton of bureaucracy involved, but that's the world we live in.
I'm with Craig 100% on this, right? We'd love to see it organically, but the fact of the matter is that there'll always be a green premium to sustainable aviation fuel. Sustainable aviation fuel at the moment is about 2.5 times the price of jet. And when you talk to the airlines have to be pragmatic about it, right? Whether you believe them or not, the airlines will tell you that they operate on razor thin margins. And the fact of the matter is fuel is about 25% of what it costs for them to fly a plane every day, right? So, you know, even Boeing, the sustainability officer at Boeing said this week at a conference in Rotterdam that, you know, you'll never see parity between Jet A and sustainable aviation fuel. Thus, here come the subsidies. I mean, the fact is, you know, Boeing has enough things on their plate rather than me commenting on the cost of sustainable aviation fuel, but I'll leave that for another time. But it's just, you know, you need these practices, or you need this money if you want to get to the goal of being carbon neutral by 2050, which is the goal of every U.S. airline at the moment.
Pete, Craig, thank you so much. We appreciate it. We need to take a quick break, and then we're checking in with Machinery Pete next.
Watch Markets Now with Michelle Rook on the Farm Journal YouTube channel, keeping you updated throughout the day on the markets at the open, midday, and close. Find out what moved the markets today and what to expect the market to do next.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Tractor Tales. This week, we're headed to Illinois to check out a Twin City tractor that had just a little bit of trouble getting started.
Well, the crank started with a mag, and we were unable to get that done, so we just took the other H we had here and ran the belt pulley, put it in the twist, and kind of started that way, kind of cheated the system, if you will. It's a 1927 Twin City 2744. My wife's grandpa had it. I'm pretty sure they bought it new when they got it. Been in the family the whole entire time. It was stuck for a year, and it just sat in the shed, and I got it out myself and kind of broke loose and got it running. But after that, some other people took over and got it in a lot better shape than when I had it. So repainted it and whatnot. My father-in-law, he's passed away now, but I don't know how old it was. Him and his sister used to drive it on thrashing runs. That's what they did. They went around and thrashed for people in the area, drove it to Sheffield. Doesn't go very fast, as you can see in the videos. You know, who knows how old they were, 9, 10 years old, driving this thing up and down the old gravel roads, towing a thrasher machine from one place to the other. I like it just because it's been in the family, you know, for a long time. Other than just think it's a monster, which it kind of is. probably weighs 10 times more than what it has horsepower, you know. I don't think they ever used it in the field whatsoever. They literally just used the belt pulley on the side of it to run the thrashing machine. That's all it did.
Thanks, Greg. Well, there's a margin squeeze setting in across farm country. One economist says there's only one way to describe it, and that's ugly. Now there are fresh concerns about rapid consolidation in the row crop side of ag. We'll have details in our Farm Journal report next.
You're watching U.S. Farm Report. Trusted, timely, tradition.
There's a margin squeeze setting in across farm country, and that's a sprouting fresh concerns about rapid consolidation in the row crop side of ag. We look at the April Ag Economist's monthly monitor in our Farm Journal report this weekend. As farmers across the U.S. continue to plant, there's a lot riding on this year's crop, and ag economists are watching closely.
In some cases, relative to the previous month, the responses were a little more positive, but relative to last year, there's still this concern of things are somewhat worse off relative to where we were 12 months ago.
University of Missouri ag economist Scott Brown helps author the Ag Economist's monthly monitor. And while this month's monitor didn't produce much change in net farm income expectations or the overall ag economic situation, economists are watching an eroding net farm income picture on farms this year.
One of the biggest concerns by far is this margin squeeze. I mean, when you really start looking at 24 budgets, I think the word I would use is ugly.
Dr. Michael Langemeyer is one of 70 ag economists surveyed in the monthly monitor. He also helps author Purdue University's Ag Economy Barometer each month.
It looks as bad as S19, maybe even slightly worse.
The April Ag Economist's monthly monitor, though, also asked a question about the risk of consolidation in the row crop side of ag.
Almost resoundingly, they said yes.
In the April monthly monitor, economists were asked if the current environment of declining commodity prices and high input costs accelerate consolidation in row crop operations and allied industries. And nearly 80% said yes.
When you think about we're headed to what's likely a period of tighter margins, I think the economists were saying, hey, that just is going to make this competition to get bigger to try to offset some of the tighter margins work in their operations.
Economists point out geographies at the greatest risk of consolidation are the Great Plains, Corn Belt, and Southeast Cotton Belt. Economists also think the size of an operation matters.
The response was smaller operations are going to struggle. Those maybe more highly leveraged are going to struggle. Operations are going to look to grow to try to offset what are going to be tighter margins. That seemed to be kind of the overwhelming response that we saw from the economists.
Economists in the monthly monitor also say anywhere that has high cash rents or land ownership is scarce are at the greatest risk of consolidation. And Langemeyer says another driving factor of possible growing consolidation could be ag tech.
One of the questions we asked on the barometer that's going to be released in May, do you primarily buy used or new machinery? And there's a bunch of people say they buy used machinery. So guess what? They're behind the technology curve, and to the extent that this precision agriculture technology, artificial intelligence, digital agriculture, the extent that all of these things are profitable, at least are potentially profitable, there's going to be a segment that's left behind.
But one possible driver of high cash rents could be the push for solar leasing on land. Langemeyer says in the last Ag Economy Barometer, they asked farmers how many had actively engaged in discussions with any companies about leasing farmland you own for solar installation.
It was 18% said that they have engaged. And so think about that. That's a huge percentage of the survey respondents have actually engaged in someone about leases. That doesn't mean they've signed anything. That means that they've actually been approached.
He says of that 18%, 56% say the rates were over $1,000 per acre, and 30% say the rates they were offered were over $1,250 per acre.
This is for the entire U.S. That's a high rate even for the Eastern Corn Belt, where our cash rents are much higher. But think about what even a $750 rate would be in the Great Plains, where the cash rents are much, much lower. And so what you're having here is these solar lease rates are multiples of the cash rent.
And Langemeyer thinks the push for solar could also spill over into the price of cash rents.
That's going to put upward pressure on cash rent, and it's probably going to upward pressure on land values.
With a price tag of more than $1,000 per acre being offered, it's enticing for farmers who are staring at crop prices below their cost of production. But the overall snapshot of the ag economy through the lens of economists shows economists are not growing more pessimistic or optimistic. Instead, there is concern about the possible shifting landscape in ag.
Now, economists were also asked if they consider the strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza impacting dairy cattle a black swan event. 64% responded no. However, economists note that could change if the spread continues to grow and if demand takes a big hit. And speaking of the growing outbreak in Chip's Corner, we'll actually hear from one of the researchers who detected viral material of the virus in 38% of the milk he sampled. But first, a glimpse of ag around the globe. That's right after the break. Now for a glimpse of ag around the world. The dispute with Mexico over GMO corn could reach a resolution by September. That's according to the Mexican economy minister. As you'll remember, this came about after Mexico issued a decree banning imports of GMO corn for food use. The U.S. arguing the decision was not based on scientific evidence. The U.S. taking issue with the announcement under USMCA rules. U.S. officials have said in the past they were optimistic about prevailing in the dispute. Traffic is starting to pick back up at the Panama Canal. Information from IMF Port Watch shows the daily vessel crossings at the canal have increased, with the 7-day moving average reaching 25 vessels last week. That's up from a low of about 21 at the end of January due to extreme drought conditions. However, the average was 35 crossings per day before the drought. Meteorologists in Panama report the country is transitioning to a wetter seasonal pattern, which is expected to continue through mid-May. The added rainfall, along with increased ship crossings, is expected to gradually alleviate the restrictions on global trade, resulting from canal disruptions since last year. And it appears China's sow herd is contracting. In fact, the country's ag ministry is saying that its hogs, sow, and pig herds are all declining. It comes amid Beijing's efforts to decrease production capacity. Officials are hoping prices will recover in the second quarter. China had almost 40 million sows at the end of March, down 500,000 head from the previous month and down more than 7% from the same time a year ago. When it comes to pork imports in China, they've been cut in half, dropping 53% in the first 3 months of the year when compared to the first 3 months of 2023. When we come back, a lab testing retail milk samples for highly pathogenic avian influenza found surprising results. Chip's Corner is next. Welcome back to Chip's Corner this weekend. Well, we talked about it earlier in the show. There are some updates when it comes to this highly pathogenic avian influenza that is impacting dairy herds across the U.S. this week. One thing we did find out, Chip, is that there are certain labs that are testing milk just right off the shelves, retail right. milk. And one of those labs in Ohio State did find fragments of the virus, viral fragments, in the milk supply. Not the live virus, thankfully, but they did find fragments. And I know you talked to one of those labs. What did you find out?
Yeah, the conversation that we had with Dr. Andrew Bowman, who you've been talking with as well, Tanya, it was really quite revealing in the fact that almost 40% of the samples that they pulled off the shelves in six different states showed the residue of the virus, not the live virus, but the residue of the virus. The reason that that is important is because it's not the 33 herds in eight Midwest states. There's the evidence from the one sampling of 150 milk samples alone is enough to indicate that it's more widespread than the 33 herds in the eight states. So how widespread is it? How is it spreading? Is it the same virus? There are a ton of questions. And the thing is, Tyne, I think what we are learning the most right now is that we don't know a lot about this outbreak. And Dr. Bowman is concerned about that as well.
I think we need a much larger net cast at this point. You know, while APHIS released 239 sequences on Sunday night, which was a great step forward, that's still not a lot of data in the grand scheme of things to try to understand. So, you know, some of it is let's understand why some animals are sick and some aren't. The other is if we find more sequences, that helps us kind of understand where the virus has been, how it's been changing. Right. Yes. Let's understand the pattern a little bit better. We need more dots on the map to help connect this up.
Yeah. More dots on the map, more data points, more information on just how wide spread this outbreak has already become. And I think we need to get past any of the concern about, PR issues on this. We need to get in front of this animal disease and gain a better understanding of what the virus is, of how widespread it is, and just exactly what the risk is to the animal population out there. And to do that, we need accurate tracking and accurate tracing of the virus and the cases of H5N1 and the bovines out there.
Yeah, well, Dr. Bowman, he hinted at it, but USDA is under a lot of criticism right now. APHIS is under a lot of criticism on how slow they've been to get information out, how slow they've been to respond. And Chip, I just want to note, we've been working on this story this week, and I had sent a note to APHIS, and about an hour later, got an email from the CDC, the head of communications for the CDC. About an hour after that, had a senior CDC official calling me, asking me to include a couple facts in our reporting, in our stories, saying that they regularly scan for unusual flu-like illnesses in emergency rooms and healthcare systems and things like that. And they have not seen any unusual flu-like activity. Right. So they're still saying the risk to human health is low. But Chip, all I want to note is I've never had a senior CDC official call me. So this tells me this is more of a concern than we're being told.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tanya, they make a great point. If the food supply was unsafe, it would be showing up in a whole lot more human cases of H5N1. And it's not. The cases that are out there are direct contact with the animals, and it's not being transmitted by the food supply. If it was, there'd be cases all over the place, and that's not the case. So,
all right, Chip, thanks for joining us. You can catch Chip every day, 10 a.m. for AgriTalk AM, 2 p.m. for AgriTalk PM. All right, when we come back, it's a new series. We're off to meet a maverick in the field. That's in Casey, Illinois. We'll have his story next.
Watch Markets Now with Michelle Rook on the Farm Journal YouTube channel, keeping you updated throughout the day on the markets at the open, midday, and close. Find out what moved the markets today and what to expect the market to do next.
Mavericks in the Field on U.S. Farm Report is brought to you by John Deere. Connecting your farm is easier than ever. From just the basics to being able to make real-time decisions wherever you are, John Deere has the tech you need.
Well, we're kicking off a new series on U.S. Farm Report this year, featuring farmers who are trailblazers and on the cutting edge of technology. It's called Mavericks in the Field. Throughout the year, we're setting out to find the unique farmers to feature and showcase how technology is changing the landscape of farming. This weekend, we're off to Casey, Illinois, to meet a farmer who's always thinking about what's next and how more advanced tech could help their family farm reach new heights. With every pass and every turn, each move in this Illinois farm field is done hands-free.
That's what I think really makes this great, is that you can do all this and you can focus more on just watching the planter.
It's hints of automation Heath Husingay has fully embraced.
And half the time, you know, I'll just sit, I sit sideways in here and I'm just, I don't have to worry about turning. I know if I have an obstacle coming up, it'll tell me.
This is the view from his office each spring, and it gives a hint into how immersed he is into the technology available in the tractor and on the planter.
I can watch my pops, I can watch my ground contact, I can watch all that good stuff. So it just frees me up to focus more on the actual planter itself than just focusing on driving the tractor.
The Illinois farmer is fluent in ag tech, but for him, he says it just comes naturally.
Well, I grew up with that stuff. Now there's so many different things to watch and see, and I don't know how you would do it by, you know, following your marker track and following all this and staying straight.
modern conveniences that have opened a new realm of realities, some that you can't quantify with a true ROI.
It's just the operator strain at the end of the day is so much more or less by not having to watch everything.
This week, Huizenga was rushing to finish planting this field before it rained. It's just another day in the life of this farmer who says even though he's an early adopter of technology on the farm, he doesn't view himself as one, but other people do.
Some of the things that we do a little different, we're quick to embrace new theories. For right or wrong, sometimes when we go in on something, we go whole hog. So, but we're always tinkering, always trying something, you know, hey, what if we do this? What if we do that? So, just embracing the unknown.
Farming on the edge of innovation is seen as risky by some, but for Huizenga, it's become the norm.
The big jump that most people talk about is auto steer and auto track. I mean, that really did change the game, but I feel like a lot of people are just stuck at that point. That technology itself just opened up the door for so many things. I think that as you embrace more of that, if you want to be in the autonomy space and you want to utilize that, I'm going to guess that, you know, having all the other things, all your other ducks in a row, having all that lined up and calibrated and mapped and actually having the data behind it is probably going to expedite your entry into that realm.
As Huizenga can better manage every pass from the seed to the fertilizer, he's also growing more precise in how he farms, but he's still willing to push the boundaries and try new things.
Actually, just over here on this 40, I had this wild hair. I had read this report that guys were doing skip row corn, and I thought, you know what, we're gonna make this work. So I think I planted two rows, turned one off, two rows, turned one off, two rows, turned one off, all the way across the planter. But I wanted to adjust my pop so that it was the same as me where I would have been planting 35,000 across the planter. And luckily, deer, I went in there and figured out how to shut the rows off and up certain rows and lower the other ones. So that was great. You know, I was planting 45 to 50,000 on those two rows and then skipping the row.
He says that one trial then brought on a load of questions.
We actually had some commercial guys call and say, hey, I think you had a problem. You know, you're spraying the field next to it over here. You might want to go fix that. I said, oh, that was on purpose.
A wild idea that actually worked.
It made like five more bushel than the test, but I haven't given up on it. I think it was maybe the wrong hybrid that I tried with it. So probably going to try that again.
But the biggest change on the horizon could be the ability for Huizenga to do more with less. That includes narrower and smaller tools running autonomously behind his combine at harvest.
Even in the fall for us, sometimes you have good falls, sometimes you have bad. And if you can just even have that thing follow you around in the combine and say, I want these stalks dug and I'm in this big block of area, I can watch the thing over there. I can basically have all my stalks worked and ready for next spring by the time I park the combine.
Technology may be racing forward, but for this maverick, he has one piece of advice for fellow farmers across the U.S. today.
Embrace the tech. I think it can be daunting at first to get set up and say, oh, I don't know if I can do that. I don't have time. Take the time to do it. Work with your, you know, dealer or whoever you're working with to get your tech, because I think it will open the door to other things you did not think that you could do that will be possible with that tech. So I just say embrace it, don't hate it, you know, learn it, and you'll be more and more comfortable with it.
If you know a maverick that we should feature, we want to hear about them. You can email us your idea at mailbag@usfarmreport.com or send us a message on Facebook. When we come back, some farmers finished planting corn the earliest they ever have. We're hitting the fields and from the farm. That's next. Well, planting is a tale of two different stories right now. USDA releasing its latest crop progress report. It says 12% of the nation's corn crop is now in the ground, 2 points ahead of the five-year average. And for soybeans, 8% is planted. That is double the average pace. And in the West, planting is happening at an impressive pace. Some farmers in Missouri, Kansas, and Iowa say they've already finished planting corn, the earliest on record. Jeff Kelzer farms in northern Kansas. Even though he saw rain last week, the wind has been so strong, it dried out the fields quickly, and he told us he's already finished planting corn.
The last few years, we've been kind of right around this time frame getting done. You know, when I was younger, we always used to want to start planting April 20th, and now all of a sudden we're wanting to get done by April 20th. So it's really changing.
He says creeks are not running and there aren't wet spots in the field to plant around. Meanwhile, in the Northern Plains, farmers have seen some delays. We spoke with a South Dakota farmer who's seen a lot of dryness lately.
We're going into probably one of the driest springs we've had in quite a while. Subsoil is fairly depleted, I think, so we're going to be down to needing timely rains just like we've had the last 3 years.
And that area recently did get a couple inches of rain, so hopefully they'll be out planting in the field soon. All right, that does it for U.S. Farm Report this weekend. Thank you so much for watching. Be sure to join us again next weekend as we work to build on our tradition. Have a great weekend, everyone.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast.